Well, there is a utopian vision, if you define utopia as a place that can never be achieved, and that is continuing to do what we're doing now. What I'm projecting into the future is a realistic science-based vision of the reintegration of humans with the rest of life.
Daniel Quinn wrote, "We're not humanity. We're just one culture out of hundreds of thousands that have lived their vision on this planet and sung their song. If it were humanity that needed changing, then we'd be out of luck. But it isn't humanity that needs changing. It's just us." This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. Today, we are speaking with environmental philosopher Glenn Albrecht about vision for the future, a vision he calls the symbiocene. Glenn and I talk about the power of words and language for putting names on the emotions that we feel, the earth emotions that can hinder us or empower us to make a better future. I'm very excited to share this conversation with you. Let's dig in. My guest today is Glenn Albrecht, an environmental philosopher who is known, among other things, for two concepts: solastalgia, which describes a form of emotional or existential distress caused by negative environmental change, and the symbiocene, which describes a possible future where, in Glenn's words, human action, culture, and enterprise will enhance mutual interdependence and mutual benefit for all living beings, species, and the health of all ecosystems. Glenn, thanks for joining me for this conversation from halfway around the world.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Phil.
Glenn, this podcast is about helping people envision radical change. I want to start with a quote from your 2010 TED Talk, if that's okay. Now, this is a TED Talk that I've asked students in my class to watch, and so I'm really excited to talk to you about it. You say in the talk, "If we're going to solve these globally significant environmental problems at national or even local levels, we're going to have to sort out what's going on in our heads." Can you tell me why this focus on our inner dramas, to use a word that you use, is so important if we're going to effectively solve problems like climate change?
I'd love to be able to give you a simple answer to that really excellent question. There's one obvious answer, which is that the practical, technological, material, political, and policy dimensions of the predicament that we're in have been total abject failures. We have not managed to do the things that have been set as goals, either at the international forum level with the United Nations Development Goals. We've not been able to achieve them with protocols like Kyoto and Paris and other climate change goals. So if you just take, are we moving in a direction which is solving these major problems that everyone agrees that we have? The answer is we're not moving in the right direction. We're actually, in fact, moving in the wrong direction. So if we're looking for why is it that we're failing, everyone says, well, it's lack of political will, and that's now the standard line that we know what to do, we've got the technology, we've got the intelligence, but we're just not doing it, and it's because of a lack of political will. Well, what does political will mean? It means that people all over the world are not voting for people that stand for the opposite of our track towards disaster or the apocalypse. Now, that's a very strange situation for the world to be in. We seem to know what it is that's going wrong. We know what we need to do to stop it, but we keep electing people that are standing for the exact opposite: more destruction, more exploitation, more extraction. And so there's clearly a cognitive dissonance going on, that we can see one thing, but our beliefs don't seem to correspond with it.
Okay, I'm with you so far, but where does that dissonance come from?
So the source of that dissonance lies somewhere inside each voter's head. We have yet to make a distinction in our minds between the actions that will fix the problem and our own commitments, our own ethical and emotional makeup. So in the end, the answer I give is that the source of our problem is deeply psychological and emotional. Our psyches are suffering a form of cognitive dissonance, which is so profound that we're not even prepared to move for the sake of our own children and grandchildren, etc. We've abandoned the future in a constant struggle, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious, to just maintain our existence in business as usual. Well, business as usual is fatal. What is this problem that's going on in our heads? Why is it that we can't see clearly the direction that we need to go in? And what can I do to help people unravel this deep dissonance that's going on in their own heads?
Right. Okay, so this brings us to your book, Earth Emotions. And in it, you talk about these different psychotraumatic mental states that for you can help us unlock this riddle of cognitive dissonance. And one of these states that you talk about in the book that I mentioned at the top of the show is solastalgia, which sounds kind of like nostalgia, but not quite. Can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, the bumper sticker version of solastalgia is the homesickness you have when you're still at home and your home environment is changing in ways that you find distressing. So it's a form of melancholia that you get when you haven't gone anywhere, you haven't done anything to degrade your own home environment, but an invasive force has come and started to dismantle the very things that you find valuable, emotionally supportive, those things that give you solace from where you are. It's the loss of the love of your own home environment. So the contrast that I made in my original definition of solastalgia was nostalgia. And that's not the concept that we think about when we want to return to Elvis Presley and blue suede shoes. That's a kind of sentimental longing for things in the past that you find desirable. The Swiss physician Hoffer defined nostalgia in 1688 or some ridiculous date like that as a potentially fatal psychological disease that afflicts people who are absent from home and miss it so badly that they can become extremely ill or even die. And I realized that we didn't have a word in the English language to describe what happens when you're at home, but your home leaves you. It's the opposite experience. The whole idea of solastalgia was to give expression in English to a feeling that was kind of universal, probably been felt for thousands of years, but was now becoming incredibly important because of the global scale of the changes that humans were implementing on the planet and themselves. In the past, it was mainly local and regional. Now it's become global.
And it's implicated in our apparent inability to connect the dots, despite having all the tools and strategies and solutions that we need, but not the political will, as you said earlier, but this gap, this lack, this gap in doing something about it. So nostalgia is implicated in that.
Yes, because the tendency without solastalgia was to blame yourself for not being able to cope with the impact. So people were distressed, and that distress was palpable, but they didn't really have a clear idea of what was going on in their heads in response to what was going on with respect to the desolation of their home environment. And of course, the mental desolation without a concept is vague. It's just distress. They knew they were unhappy. They were distressed. But it wasn't a concept that made any sense. Distress applies to a million things. And so the creation of solastalgia was the idea was to give people a name for a particular kind of distress that's connected to earth distress, hence the psychotoratic earth psyche relationships. And so solastalgia enables people to understand more clearly for themselves what type of distress they're experiencing. And importantly, it enables them to share that distress with others using a common language. And that's an incredibly important form of empowerment. And that brings me to the final point, which is that the causes of the distress is external. So as a result, understanding the problem that you face using a common language and then seeing that the cause of your solastalgia is external to you, it's an invasive force, it gives you a fair idea what it is that's needed to defeat that solastalgia. It's not to drink another half a bottle of red wine. It's to actually confront the politics, the economics, which are causing the problem that you face.
Okay, so that's solastalgia. And more recently, you've also added another term to our vernacular, and that's the Symbiocene, ostensibly in response to this notion that we're living in a time called the Anthropocene, where human activities are dominating all processes on the planet to the point where we're impacting Earth's geological history. So you're proposing the Symbiocene as a vision, I think. Can you tell us about it?
Well, I've created what I call the Symbiocene, a meme, a cultural replicator, as described by Richard Dawkins in his famous or infamous book, The Selfish Gene. The selfish gene hypothesis itself is controversial, but what I think is brilliant out of Dawkins' work is the concept of the meme. The meme as a cultural replicator is something which I see as potentially and increasingly more powerful than the forces that are tearing the world apart. So an era where humans reintegrate symbiotically with the forms and processes with nature is something that I see as incredibly realistic in its response to the problem that we're in. So I've been criticized for dreaming and coming up with utopian visions of the future. Well, there is a utopian vision if you define utopia as a place that can never be achieved, and that is continuing to do what we're doing now. It cannot be projected indefinitely into the future without extinction, disaster, mass misery. What I'm projecting into the future is a realistic science-based vision of the reintegration of humans with the rest of life. Now, how we do that is, it's multidimensional. It's highly technological. It involves art and culture in all of its dimensions. In fact, everything that humans do have to be reincorporated into the idea of the Symbiocene. That's where we came from, in a sense. The real understanding that I see is needed is to project what we're doing now into the future and accepting that that is unmitigated disaster.
Mm. It strikes me also, you talked about how we just keep on with this notion that we can keep on keeping on. We go to extreme lengths to convince ourselves that what we're doing, the impacts that we're having, the harms that we cause, that they're just who we are. They're part of our human nature. And so even when you raise the possibility of moving our lives in the direction of something symbiotic, something where win-win scenarios are possible, there's such an avalanche of skepticism and it's an absurdity that it's against our human nature. But what you're talking about is that we must move in those directions. And let's, what I'm trying to do in part with this podcast is help people envision the better options, the better futures. And so you brought us to hope in this last answer. And it's interesting and full circle because the very first episode of this podcast was with an author named Ellen Kelsey, who wrote a book called Hope Matters. And I'm curious in this conversation to hear you say a bit about hope and what we do with hope.
Right. The best concept of hope that I've come across is radical hope. Jonathan Lear, a hope of a better future without necessarily having a clear idea of what exactly that future would look like. Well, I don't think we have that luxury anymore. So I now talk about radical anticipation. What we have to do now is get impatient for the Symbiocene because we know that it's possible for us to create it and live within it. So I'm beginning to think that the critique of hope is probably, it's harsh, but it's probably deserved. For me, the radical anticipation takes that hope just that little bit further. I can actually see what the future looks like. I'm not Nostradamus, but I have in my head this vision of a symbioscene, which once you're in, is impossible to get out of because it's delivering exactly the things that humans need for their well-being, their growth in the emotional and maturation sense of the word, something which is good, not something which is cancerous or parasitic. And so because I have this vision and it's so strongly embedded in me, I become not so much hopeful but impatient. It even moves from impatience. I have a concept which I call terra furi, which is earth anger. I flip into a form of anger, which is creative, not destructive. I don't want to go around killing people or anything like that. I want to wake people up. You know, it's like sleepers wake. You're walking, sleepwalking into a disaster of your own making, and that we need to be creative, to be innovative, to wake you up.
I really like that. I really like that, and I appreciate it. And you've given me some language to that helps me, radical anticipation. And I can relate. I feel the frustration that you feel, also the hope that you feel. And I find myself some days in one state and some days in the other. I have one more question for you. It's something of a standard on this show. And I think you've already answered this question sort of in a very high or broad level, but I'm curious to hear, what's something that you'd like to see unfold in your lifetime that you radically anticipate, and how close are we?
Well, what my trite answer is the symbioscene, and I want it tomorrow. You know, it's like that, the old union, we want change. When do you want it? We want it now. Now is good enough for me. The more detailed answer, I guess, is that, I mean, it's a really tricky one because there are no trite answers. It's what appears to be a slow process of change, but we're now seeing the science telling us, for example, we've got to get to some kind of stability in our CO2 emissions by 2030. Well, I'm now 69. Let's put another decade on that. So within my lifetime, a realistic, almost globally accepted limit on what humans can do to the atmosphere is reached. And, you know, we're already at 420 something parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, or CO2 equivalent. So if we could achieve that, by itself would be something that I can celebrate. But what's missing is the structural component, the idea that our political and policy systems need to be doing on global scale the changes that are needed. So I would like to see those kinds of commitments occur within my lifetime. The rest of them, the individual lifestyle ones, I think people are moving in that direction fairly rapidly, so there's some degree of optimism there. So it's a complex answer to what sounds like a simple question. You know, I got a 7-year-old granddaughter. What I'd like to see most is that she grows up, and you know, in another 7 years, she'll be a teenager with views of her own, wanting to express her views about the state of the world and what's going on. I don't want her to enter the world, or a world which is on not only on the precipice of the edge of an apocalyptic future, but of course, based on what I've said previously, I want her to be on the edge of a symbiocene world where she can see clearly a role for herself, for her peers, a future which is not only, you know, just materialistically worth having, but one that's beautiful, engaging, interesting, challenging, creative. You know, this is what the fate of Homo sapiens should be. You know, I'm in my 70th year. I'm not going to be hanging around for a hell of a lot longer. But I write in Earth Emotions that at the very end, that one of the things I would love to see is words like solastalgia being taken out of dictionaries and not used any longer by academics and journalists because it's become redundant. You know, I created it because it was needed. I want it taken out of our language when it's no longer needed.
Oh, I appreciate all of that answer in all of its different facets. My daughter is 7, and so I am right there with you in wanting that for her. Thank you for putting words to it. I appreciate it. And thank you for this entire conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I hope your perspective is one that seems to be rare in the world of podcasting and media, that actually looking at an optimistic future, for me, as the Americans call it, a no-brainer. You know, we have to be doing this. And so all power, clean, renewable, to you for attempting it. And if I can help you in that cause, you know, I feel as if that's, again, the start of the symbiosis. Once somebody listens to your podcast and they're in it, they'll never get out of it.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks for listening. This is the Second Transition Podcast. You can learn more about Glenn's work in the episode notes. This episode was produced on the treaty lands and traditional territories of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as Dish with One Spoon Territory. The Second Transition Podcast is produced with support from the Arrow Food Institute at the University of Guelph and from Voice Ed Radio. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.